ॐ असतो मा सद्गमया, तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमया, मृत्योर्मा अमृतंगमया। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। हरिः ॐ। लॉर्ड, लीड अस फ्रॉम द अनरियल टू द रियल, लीड अस फ्रॉम इग्नोरेंस to illumination, lead us from death to immortality. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto all.
What is Hinduism? In this context, we have been discussing that there are two views how religions originate. Swami Vivekananda himself has been dealing with this subject. I will just quote from him. These two views seem to be prevalent. What was the one view? That religion started with what is called personification or deifying the nature. And the second view is worship of the ancestors. And I also mentioned that if we study the beginnings of our scriptures called Vedas, even today you will find evidences for both these things together. Hindus are the greatest ritualists in the world. And you will see they worship everything. Tree, stone, an animal, a bird, anything that moves or doesn't move, a mountain, a river, everything they worship. What is the idea behind? Idea is, this nature is, it is horrifying, frightening. It is also benevolent. It also sustains us. But it also destroys us. We want to be sustained, protected, but we do not wish to get destroyed. What is it? What is this force within this nature which overwhelms us, which tries to dominate us, which limits us? And is there any way to overcome it? There must be somebody there. Something inside that. What could it be? There must be something called a spirit, greater than all of us put together. If I can somehow propitiate it, then maybe by its grace, my freedom can extend. So this is one view. The second view is, people started worshipping ancestors. And in that context, we discussed that first of all, we all wish none of our relatives should die. So by implication, if they do not die, we also do not die. The second implication is, somehow, by the very fact of death, they go beyond this body, and maybe that they acquire an extensive power, extensive knowledge. And evidences of these are also seen, as I mentioned in my last class, even today among Hindus. This is how we also extend our worship of ghosts, spirits, demigods, and innumerable things like that. So let me give an example from Sri Ramakrishna's life itself. Sri Ramakrishna was practicing intense spiritual disciplines at Dakshineswar, and it so appeared that he became mad, and his mother got worried, and she recalled him back to Kamarpukur. What was she doing? What did she do? She invited some what we call magicians, mantrikas, and who had control of some demigods. Said, what is wrong with my son? And it is not mumbo jumbo really. It worked. So they invoked the gods and the demigods, and they came and they said, there is nothing wrong. They had correct knowledge that your son is a very spiritual person. It is not derangement of the brain. How do we know that they are real? Because they also pointed out, O Gadai, addressing Ramakrishna by his first name, why do you chew betel nuts so much? Don't you know it produces more desires in you? You must have control. Which was true, because nobody knew about it. Ramakrishna knew. So immediately he reduced his quota of betel nuts. So even today, we invite so many ghosts and other things. In fact, one of the most blockbuster films was made on this concept. What am I talking about? The Exorcist. In case there are some of you who think you are very rational, in case you think that these are all figments of human brain, do not forget that in Sri Ramakrishna's life, there are several evidences are there. Just to remind you, you know, when Sri Ramakrishna visited Gopalar Ma's house, he saw some spirits there. Swami Vivekananda saw, Swami Brahmananda saw, many direct disciples had seen. Even Swami Vireshwarananda had seen. Now, the point I am trying to make is not the establishment of merely the ghosts. That is one of the factors. Why is it important for us? Because it shows life doesn't end with this 60 years of our living here. It extends beyond. By extension, by implication, it also means that we are also immortal somehow. The fall of this body is only a change of state and nothing more than that. Okay. The second factor is even more interesting because somehow we believe these ghosts have more power than us and we want power. What is the concept of power? Why do we want power? There is a negative reason for that. There is a positive reason also. So what is the negative reason? That somehow we want to overcome the limitations of our sense organs. Perhaps a ghost could tell me what my enemy is doing. Perhaps a ghost could tell me how is the stock market going to behave day after tomorrow. This is extending my limited powers. The second reason is I want to be happy. Maybe these gods have more power. They can bestow upon me some boons. You know, the popular stories, genes and all those things. They can grant me what I cannot ordinarily get by myself. This way, this on the one side, worship of the animated nature, deifying it. On the other side, worship of the ancestors also went on side by side. Both these views have a common purpose. What is the purpose? As I quoted from Swami Vivekananda last class, religion is an attempt to go beyond the limitations of the senses. So, we have got two struggles in life. One struggle is we want to be, we want to continue our life. Second limitation is we want to be happier than what we are. So, these are the two purposes for either we worship nature or we worship ancestors. Now, while worshipping the nature, we deify them. So Hindus excel in all these things. They go to the sky is the limit. So there is a rain god, there is a sun god, there is a moon god, there is a wind god, there is a god for everything. So the question arose, you see, religion is like an organism. It's like a growing organism. All the time it goes on growing. So that means religious ideas are our understanding of what religion truly is. As we grow, as time passes, we grow in this understanding. So that's what happened in every religion. But unfortunately, in some religions, the growth has been put sternly aside. It has been stopped. That is for another reason. When the occasion comes, I shall mention it. But whereas Hinduism had gone to the furthest limit beyond which one cannot go. What is the next idea? There is a wind god. There is a sun god. There is a rain god. There is an earth goddess. There is a god or goddess for everything we see. Now the problem comes now that which god should we worship? You know, Hindus worship so many gods and goddesses. It's wonderful because you have the freedom to choose whom you like. If you don't like somebody, or you can blackmail them, you know. You can blackmail them, saying, look, if you are not favorable to me, I am going to change my party. Actually, this had happened in the life of Holy Mother. I am going to, you know, spice it up, my talks a little bit. This happened, you know. These goddesses had come. They have been worshipped by Holy Mother's mother, Shyama Sundari Devi. And she was very happy. She wanted to continue the worship next year also. Then my Holy Mother objected, "No, who is going to go to all that trouble? So once you worship, that is fine." That night, these goddesses appeared in Holy Mother's dream. I said, "Tahole ki ora dakche okane jabo. If so, shall I go to the other house? They are calling me." Say, meaning that don't think I am not in demand. I am very much in demand. If you don't want to worship me, that I will go there. And Holy Mother immediately said, no, I didn't mean it. You stay here. I will worship you every year. And so the worship is continuing. Anyway, fun aside, the question comes, whom should we worship? This question is not an academic question because in those days, mind you, the beginning of what we call before our organized human societies really came into their own, people were living in a type of tribal societies. Now, between these tribal societies, there used to be conflicts, war for mates, for better food, and etc. Advantages. Now, how do they decide which tribe is stronger? How do they decide? So each tribe has got his own god or goddess. So there would be fight between these two tribes. And whichever tribe wins, somehow it attributes that their winning the war is due to the blessing of the god or goddess that they are worshipping. Naturally, the tribe which had lost, what it immediately says, our god or goddess is useless, so it is better that I accept the other goddess. You know, that is what happens in politics. This party has lost, immediately some people in India, you know, they just shift over. So this is how the question came, whom should we worship? That means, who is the most powerful one? But here the search has gone inside, and then they found out what we are calling a different gods and goddesses. Perhaps they are not different at all, but manifestations may be of this one and the same power. So this is how every religion, sooner or later, came to the idea which is called monotheistic idea, one God. Not many gods, but one God. But there is an interesting point here, which Swami Vivekananda points out to us. Whereas in other religions, that one after the other, the gods have been taken up, have been tested, and then discarded. Ultimately, one God stood up, which is called monotheistic idea. Thou shalt worship no other God excepting God. All the other forms which have been worshipped have been discarded. Now, Hindu religion also started with the same idea. One after the other. Here is Indra. Indra is the most supreme God. Then Varuna, he is the supreme God. But what is the difference between Hindu approach and other approaches is that a most wonderful idea, perhaps 11,000 years back, has appeared. That idea is what specializes Hinduism even till today. And confirmed by Sri Ramakrishna. What was that idea? Ekam sat vipraha bahudha vadanti. Truth is one, but sages call it by various names. Somehow, this most marvelous idea had come into the, or intuitively felt, truth is one, but different people call it by different names. Couch it in different terms, dress it in different ways, worship in different forms, different names, different qualities. Now, what is the difference this made? Predominantly, it made two differences. One difference was, none of the older gods had been discarded. All of them have been included there. And said, you worship Ganesha, you worship Kartikeya, you worship Rama, you worship Krishna, you worship your own mother, you worship your own guru. So it doesn't matter. It is whom you worship. But you have to attribute, this is the supreme reality. That is the idea. This is called symbolization. A human form, a piece of stone, a picture, an icon, These stand as symbols. A symbol has always the what is called purpose of pointing to something beyond itself. Have you ever seen an arrow sign? What does the arrow sign mean? It says, go beyond this, go this way, that is the right way. That is the idea. A symbol, Indra, Chandra, Varuna, Rama, Krishna, Jesus, Buddha, these are all symbols. They are all symbolic of the supreme reality. Now here is another point. Why should these be considered as symbols? Because we find in them excellences, especially in the so-called incarnations of God. If at all we have any idea of God, the highest concept of God can come only by studying through these great personalities. What power! 2000 years back Jesus Christ was born. Even now, what power! In his name, people are moved. They renounce. They give up everything. They are even ready to give up their lives. So also in Islam, so also in Hinduism. They may not commit suicide, but they are prepared to give up everything, go to the solitary place and spend whole life in austerity. Somehow they move the hearts of the people, and they have exhibited tremendous power. They could change the personalities. They could, of course, bestow boons. They could give freedom. We all believe in it. So this is the idea that ekam sat vipra bahudha vadanti. So mainly religion proceeded through these two paths. One is divinization of what we see around us, which is nature worship. Second is worship of the ancestors. The difference is nature is visible to us, whereas ancestors, our dead ancestors, are invisible to us. So through one, we want more and more power, less and less limitation. Through the other, somehow we want to have more knowledge, and we also want to be immortal. What is the essence of these two views? I want to live forever, I want to know more, and I want to be happy. All these three ideas are compressed, as it were, into one idea. What is that? Freedom. I want to be free from death. I want to be free from ignorance. I want to be free from limitations. Asatoma sadgamaya, tamasoma jyotirgamaya, mrityorma amrutangamaya. The prayer just now I have uttered, lead me from the unreal to the real, from ignorance to illumination, from death to immortality. That is the idea. All these three ideas have been compressed into one form, which is called freedom, the struggle for freedom, or the attempt to go beyond the limitations of the senses. That is what is the beginnings of religion. And Swamiji goes further. Every living creature, by its very life, it is struggling. Why do you breathe? Because you want to be free from death. Why do you observe things through your eyes, through your ears? Because you want to know what is going on around. What do you do from morning till evening? When you are cooking a nice meal, adding some nice masala, spice, what are you doing? You want to be more happy. When you are conveying some important information, adding your own masala to it, what are you trying to do? Make it very palatable, pleasant. What is your advertisement? Truth plus heavy masala. This is called advertisement. Okay. So now I read from Swami Vivekananda. These two views, that is to say, worship of the ancestors, deifying of the nature, though they seem to be contradictory, can be reconciled on a third basis, which to my mind is the real germ of religion, and that I propose to call the struggle to transcend the limitations of the senses. Either man goes to seek for the spirits of his ancestors, the spirits of the dead, that is, he wants to get a glimpse of what there is after the body is dissolved, or he desires to understand the power working behind the stupendous phenomena of nature. Whichever of these is the case, one thing is certain, that he tries to transcend the limitations of the senses. He cannot remain satisfied with his senses. He wants to go beyond them. To me, it seems very natural that the first glimpse of religion should come through dreams. Here is a most marvelous idea. We never thought about it. I never thought about it. Dreams. So what do the dreams do? Here is, I will read Swami Vivekananda. The first idea of immortality man may well get through dreams. Is that not a most wonderful state? Think of it. Is it not a wonderful state? A student who failed goes to the college and finds out he has failed his examination, goes to sleep and dreams that he has passed first class first. As long as the dream lasts, what a marvelous state it is. Even during the sleep state, when the body is apparently dead, the mind goes on with all its intricate workings. What wonder that men will at once come to the conclusion that when this body is dissolved forever, the same working will go on? This, to my mind, would be a more natural explanation of the supernatural. And through this dream idea, the human mind rises to higher and higher conceptions. Mind you, Swamiji didn't stop there. We see so many weird things in our dreams. Most of them we know are idle fantasies, imaginations, nothing more than that. But I would not stop with that, neither Swami Vivekananda. Dreams can be of varieties. There are, most of our dreams are what is called idle thoughts, concretized or pictured. There are also dreams which are foretellers of what is going to happen in future. There are also dreams where one can have visions of higher realities. So there are also dreams not only of higher realities, even revealing some of the scientific or literary truths. One example is, I think the chemical composition of the benzyme was discovered through a dream of the scientist, I forget his name, at a snake trying to swallow its own tail, gives him the idea what is the chemical composition. Another is, I think it was Robert Louis Stevenson, who had this Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, that entire story had come in his dream as though it just was waiting. All that he said was, I have to take up paper and pencil, and the story wrote itself out. And interestingly, there was a great sage in India called Sri Aurobindo, and he had done lot of experimentation with what you call automatic writing. So as though from the deep unconscious, some wonderful things have come. And then he himself was surprised. Such marvelous things could come out of his unconscious mind. Yes, so many things will come out. The whole point is, dreams are facts that happen in our mind. In our mind. So mind is the instrument. Dreams you leave aside. What is important is, if such wonderful truths can be experienced in dreams, and this is done by the mind, maybe the mind holds the key to the secrets we are seeking, which is freedom, maybe our freedom. And is it not a fact? Tell me what your thoughts are, I can tell you who you are. We are what our thoughts are. Is it not a fact? So this is the simple truth. And if you say, that is what Sri Ramakrishna puts in a very simple way. He says, the wretch who goes on saying, I am weak, I am a sinner, he becomes more wretched. And even if he was not a sinner, very soon he will become a sinner. In psychological language is what you call phobia, and what is called accident prone, we call it. Fellow goes on thinking, so I will meet an accident, I will meet, and he fulfills his own thought very soon. So our mind holds the tremendous secret. So Sri Ramakrishna says, the person who says, I am divine, very soon what happens? He feels he is divine, he is free. Everything lies in the mind. This was the great truth that has been expressed so beautifully in Sanskrit language. Mana eva manushyanam karanam bandha mokshayo. Mind alone is the cause of both bondage and freedom. which is absolutely true. You are as happy as you think you are happy, or as unhappy as you think you are unhappy. This is the truth. Anyway, so this state of things we find in all the organized religions of the world, called either ecstasy or inspiration. Swami Vivekananda, he says, you know, very soon people came to realize that dreams are just idle fancies, but by that time the search has begun. But a tremendous turn has taken. What is that turn? Instead of searching outside, now the search has become inward. That is the greatest change that has taken place. All the while people have been searching. Is it in the tree? Is it in the dead ancestor? Is the freedom somewhere else on Himalayas? Then suddenly found, maybe it is right here, right within me. By this time, the search had begun, and the search was inward, and man continued inquiring more deeply into the different stages of the mind and discovered higher states than either the waking or the dreaming. This state of things we find in all the organized religions of the world, called either ecstasy or inspiration. In all organized religions, their founders, prophets and messengers are declared to have gone into states of mind that were neither waking nor sleeping, in which they came face to face with a new series of facts relating to what is called the spiritual kingdom. They realized things there much more intensely than we realize facts around us in our waking state. Thus, a tremendous statement is made by all religions that the human mind at certain moments transcends not only the limitations of the senses but also the power of reasoning. It then comes face to face with facts which it could never have sensed, could never have reasoned out. These facts are the basis of all the religions of the world. How do we know? You see, it looks, what a beautiful study by Swami Vivekananda. See, we made a statement. These are the origin of every religion. What is it? There are certain states beyond body, beyond the mind. Mind has the power to get out of itself, to transcend itself, and then something happens. All the religions, all the prophets, they claim one thing. You know what they claim? That the supersensuous experience is beyond the mind. And their recorded experiences are what we call scriptures of the world. Vedas, Bibles, the Quran, and the Tripitaka, whatever. What are these scriptures? These are the very basis, the foundation as it were, of every religion. Take away the scripture, what remains? Empty shell, nothing. There will be no religion. We will come to that point later on. So, what happened? First of all, the search has gone from the outer to the inner. It has become inward. Secondly, they discovered that there is a tremendous powers of the mind. The mind has tremendous powers. And the highest of that power is it can go beyond itself. But even from the point of view of knowledge and power, you know, you say a person is very intelligent, very Einstein. Where is that intelligence? Is it outside him or inside him? Where is it? It is in his mind. Don't make any mistake. It is not in the brain. The brain is only an instrument. It is in the mind. That is one fact. Then, there is the third factor is there. It's the most wonderful factor. You know what is this fact? The further inward they went, the more generalized the ideas have become, the more abstract they be. You see, God is not a person, because if he is a person, he has a name, he has a form, and he can only occupy a particular space. But God is everywhere, is it not? God is for all times, is it not? Is it an abstract idea or is it a concrete idea? So, the third factor came in. The more abstract an idea, the more powerful it is, and the more subtler it is, and the more longer lasting it is. And of course, The highest peak of all abstractions is what in simple terms we call God. We will come to that point. So, we find one characteristic common to all religions. They are all abstractions as contrasted with the concrete discoveries of physics. Abstraction, either in the form of an abstracted presence or as an omnipresent being, as an abstract personality called God, as a moral law, or in the form of the abstract essence underlying every existence. I will give one instance again from Hindu religion. Hindus worship many, many gods and goddesses. In fact, Hindus manufacture gods and goddesses. Hindus manufacture gods and goddesses. Who is great? The manufactured or the manufacturer? Tell me, who is great? So you see, Sri Ramakrishna was not a god. Before 1936, was he a god? Nobody knew about him. He was born only in 1836. And then he was born. And then he was recognized. And then he became now, see, millions and millions worship him. See, we made him God. The second idea that we get is that this most wonderful idea of the abstraction, the more it is abstracted, the subtler it becomes, because it is just the diametrically opposite of what is concrete, and the more lasting it becomes, immortal it becomes. So that is how all the power, all the knowledge, this is what we call Sat Chit Ananda. Sat means absolute existence. Say, for example, here is a book. It has an existence, but it's very limited existence. It didn't exist 5 minutes earlier. It is existing now. Maybe after 5 minutes it will go out of existence. But what is absolute existence? Where does it go? From where it has come, it will go. That from which everything originates, that in which it continues to live, that unto which again it returns back, that is called absolute existence, Sat. Then the another idea is, we have to understand knowledge. We use the word knowledge all the time. What is knowledge? Knowledge is a limited piece of consciousness. See, we have got consciousness. For example, you are sitting out in the garden and you are not doing anything, just looking at it. There is no idea in the mind excepting that you are enjoying yourself. Suddenly a bird flies. Immediately you say, oh, this is a bird. What happened? That abstracted consciousness of yours, which was not projecting anything, suddenly it became concentrated, as it were, on a particular small object, which is called a bird, and you got the knowledge, this is a bird. I am seeing a bird. But where does there are infinite number of objects in this world. How much knowledge can you get? Very little, because you don't have time, your instruments are very limited. But is there any way of having the knowledge of everything? Is it possible? Yes, it is possible. How is it possible? Not in its particularity, but in its essence or generality. How does this work? I'll give an example. Beautiful example, you know. Supposing, Sri Ramakrishna has given this example. Supposing you want to cook rice. You put a pot full of rice. And after 20 minutes, you want to know, say, how whether the rice is cooked properly or not. What do you need to do? Do you need to press every grain there? Or do you only press one grain and you will know about entire rice? So, this is the simple, beautiful example given by Sri Ramakrishna following the teachings of the Upanishads. One thing I have to tell you before I proceed. Every teaching of Sri Ramakrishna stems from the Upanishadic teachings. So, the Upanishads tell us, my dear, if you want to know what is the nature of this ornament, for example, necklace, what is the nature of that ornament, for example, a ring, then there is no way you can get the knowledge about everything. But if these ornaments are made out of gold, if you have knowledge about gold, then you have knowledge about all the ornaments, which have been made since the beginning of creation, which are there now, which will be made in future until the end of creation. You will have knowledge. Now I will come to physics. You see, here is man, here is a tree, here is a bird, here is a wood, piece of wood. How many pieces of knowledge are you going to get? Go to their origin. Where from they originated? Let us say from the physics point of view, atoms, right? So what is the origin of atoms? Split the atoms. Go to their basic material. What is it? Particles or waves, or ultimately we use a simple word, matter. Everything has come out of matter. If you have knowledge of matter, have you knowledge of everything in this world or not? But Vedanta goes further and says, even matter is only a modification of consciousness. Therefore, if you have knowledge of consciousness, then you have knowledge of everything else in this world. This wonderful truth, he has put it in another way. You see, if you want to touch the Ganga, Ganges, what do you need to do? Do you have to go on touching it from the Himalayas until Ganga Sagar? Or any point you touch the Ganges, you have touched the Ganges? That means, if you know that basic material, from which the whole universe is nothing but different manifestations, then you know all the knowledge that is to be known about that particular, right? And what is the essence of everything? It is nothing but what they call Brahman, Chit, Sat and Chit. What is the, what our endeavor, what are we struggling for? Worshipping ancestors, worshipping nature, worshipping images of gods and goddesses. What is the purpose? I want to live happily, eternally. Infinite, eternal happiness. And God is of that nature. Where is that happiness? So you ask, instead of asking where is that happiness, ask where is the unhappiness. Where is the unhappiness? I don't have that thing. So you have that. I don't have the other thing. So you don't have that. So get it. Then how many things you can get? No. Then what should you do? You become everything. You become the infinite. Then what happens? You are everything. Everything is you. There is nothing aside from you. This idea of Purnatva, perfection, or what Swami Vivekananda calls infinity. Then you are free from unhappiness. Then that means you are Ananda Swarupa. You have the nature of bliss, because there is no desire, there is no imperfection, therefore there is no seeking, there is no effort, there is no fear, there is no separation. This marvelous truth has been given in three words, comprised in three words, Sat, Chit, Ananda. So the search is for Satchidananda. So that is what he says, Swami Vivekananda says here. Thus, we are always struggling to raise ourselves up to that ideal. Every human being, whosoever and wheresoever he may be, has an ideal of infinite power. Every human being has an ideal of infinite pleasure. Then comes a marvelous turn, another turn in religion. What is called religion? What is it? That if you want infinity, any amount of finite things put together cannot bring infinity. Only infinity can have infinity. As an American cliche says, you know, yes, you can buy the whole supermarket. Where will you put? So let it be there. So all that you need to think is, this is mine. You see, what are you going to suppose? You have enough money. And say an Arab, rich Arab, oil rich Arab, has billions of dollars. And he purchases this, let us say, Marks and Spencer's, all the food that is there in Marks. Will he be able to eat it? So let it be there. All that you need to do is, yes, this is mine. That's it. Is it possible? Yes, it's possible. How? You identify yourself and say, the owner of this Marks and Spencer's is none other than my own self. Finished? That is called religion. The ultimate point of perfection of religion is nothing but through various spiritual disciplines, slowly you rid yourself of this limitation. first body, then sense organs, then mind, then ultimately the egotism, and then what remains, you become one with everything. This is true religion. So, then he says, one thing they found out, you know, that if you want religion, then you have to give up. Because the understanding comes that through finite means the infinity cannot be. That is called vairagya, turning away, nivritti. This is called renunciation. So that is what makes it. Now we have covered the essential points, excepting I want to mention two other points with regard to this. He said, origins of religions began with the worship of nature, worship of the ancestors. Now, human beings are always, there are clever human beings. They want power. They interpose themselves in between ordinary human beings and these so-called higher powers and say, look, we somehow have a hotline. We have somehow a communication. And why do you want to go to so much trouble? You pay me a little bit of fee and I will do your work for you. That is, all that I need is a little bit of payment. These are called magicians. You know, even today if you think the idea of a magician has gone out of order, forget about it. They're faith healers. And there are, you know, any number of, you know, this. And suppose, you know, some student, the son of a devotee, tomorrow examination is there. What do you think? Today they will bring rasagullas to me. I said, you never fed rasagullas in the fast to me. Suddenly, why this so much devotion? And immediately I come to know, Swamiji, tomorrow my son is appearing for the exam. Will you please pray to God? I say, certainly I will pray for God. I never said he is going to pass or fail. I say, I am going to pray. I will pray. But the result depends upon your son's efforts and also God's grace. So these middlemen, in Hindu religion also these middlemen came. They are called at the beginning Purohits. Purohita means he who stands between me and gods. And the best of these, what we call in English language, priests, is in the form of Agni, fire. Fire. So fire is the, everything is put in the fire. You put money, you put fruits, even now we do homas, you put so many things, valuable things. What is the idea? Idea is the fire carries it. You put in the fire which is invisible and the fire reduces it to its essence and fire carries it to the gods and the gods, they send the gifts, whatever they want to give you and that will come back again to you in a visible form. See the whole Ramayana. What did Dasharatha do when he wanted children? He performed the yagna, what you call sacrifice, fire sacrifice. And this devata came and gave this in a cup, what we call rice pudding. And you give it to your wives and she will bear children. This is what we also do. We all accept the prasada, sacramental food, with great reverence. So, this is one idea, priests. Priesthood and magicians or shamans are closely interrelated. So, what they do is, they claim they have special powers. But then, what they say is, this is not my power. My power comes from worshipping a particular demon or ghost or god or goddess. So, you pay me the proper fees, I will contact my boss, and my boss, I can assure you, will give you the promotion or whatever it is. We have not lost the idea. These are all stages in the religious growth we have to accept. So the first idea is a magician or shaman. And these magicians or shamans have become, in a way of speaking, in the religious history of the religious development, a kind of what is called separated beings outside society. They don't fall into any category. They are feared, more feared than respected. But gradually, as people became accustomed to it, Then these magicians slowly assumed a regular post. They have become what is their temporary post has become confirmed as permanent post. And they assumed the name of a priest. So these are the some of the ideas that have come. Now every religion, it has undergone through these three stages. But some religions have stopped at the second stage of the growth, never went further. Swami Vivekananda explains it. What are these three stages? The first stage is that there are many gods, means many powers, many goddesses, many spirits, etc. This is called polytheism. As man's understanding became greater, then he developed into, there are not many powers, but it is one particular power, one infinite source of power manifesting in different ways. As I compare it to credit card. You see, with credit card you can buy food, you can buy clothes, you can buy aeroplane ticket, or you can buy a bomb, or you can commit suicide, you can do whatever you like. It can take any form. So one particular, this is called monotheism. This is the second. And many religions have stopped with the growth of that. Though I would not say they completely stopped, but what I meant is that the priests, who have meanwhile assumed a very powerful position, did not want people to go any further to that abstract principle called the impersonal being or the ultimate reality, because if people go to that idea of the ultimate reality, they don't need your particular interference. You can get that power for yourself. If everybody is getting water, suppose it's constantly raining, first class water. Who are Thames Water Company? Many assiduous, no, God is only, it's our God. And you can only access him through us. There is no other way. But Hindus have gone further and said, however personal, however wonderful a God is, this is not what we want. Because even he limits my freedom. Who the hell is he to boss over me and say, I will create you, I will destroy you. Therefore they went further and then they came to this marvelous idea that it is Brahman. Brahman means he is everywhere. Even to say he is a wrong. It is everywhere, whatever word you say. He is everywhere means what? Don't have the dualistic idea that is in the ocean there is water. There is a land which is depressed in a vast way, and in that vast depression it is filled with vast amount of water. Not like that. He is everywhere means he is everything. If he is everything, what am I? I am also that same supreme reality. So that is what the Hindu rishis have discovered, and these are the two principles which have special contribution to make to the world's religious thought. Hindus, two important religious ideals. One is the highest ultimate reality is impersonal. From it everything has come. It is formless, it is nameless, it is qualityless. Nirakara, nirguna, nirvisesha, called simply Brahman. From Brahman came Brahma, Vishnu, Maheshwara, whatever other names you call. The second idea is, it is that one supreme reality. We are all worshipping in different names, different forms and different qualities, attributing different qualities. I will give you one example. You see, different names. Rama, Krishna, Shiva, Jesus, Allah, Buddha. These are different names. But it is the same principle. Different forms. Krishna is one form. Rama is another form. Divine Mother is another form. And Jesus is another form, etc. And different qualities. What are those qualities? Suppose you want power. Whom do you worship? Either you worship Kali, Mother Kali, or you worship Lord Ganesha or Kartikeya. Kartikeya is the god of success. Okay, if you want pass examinations, whom will you worship? If you want wealth, or happiness, whom do you worship? Lakshmi. And if you want realization of God, then whom do you worship? Guru, your particular guru. So you see, this is the very special thing. No other religion teaches this. Why they can't teach? Because they have stopped accessing that highest, going to the highest concept. There were people, I'm not saying nobody has gone, but they have actively suppressed some mystics who have experienced that highest truth and then wanted to preach it. They have been suppressed, their books have been banned. For example, in Christianity, Meister Eckhart's books, he has been oppressed, his books have been banned from 12th century until this 19th century. Only in the last, after the 18th and 19th centuries, his books have become more popular now. If you look at Islam, and you see, there is a section called Sufism, mystics called Sufis. And they have been tortured, they have been killed, they have been burnt. And their books have never been, not only at that time, even till today, in Orthodox Muslim countries, these Sufis are taboo, period. No way. They can only practice it in countries like India or in UK or in USA. Sufi mystics, even today. But in India, nobody was, even an atheist, if a rank atheist comes to a Hindu temple or Varanasi, and says God is superstition, religion is opium of the masses, etc., etc., the people will clap him and said, well said, now go and have a good dinner. And then what they do? They straight proceed to the temple, offer their worship, heartfelt, and then go away. They give tremendous freedom. Freedom is the condition of growth. That is why in India, religion grew. Whereas it suppressed the society. That is why society became constricted. In the West, society has been given complete freedom. And so it grew. But religion has been completely suppressed even today. That's why it did not grow at all. So these are the two ideas. But one question that comes is, who is a Hindu? How do I know? So what is Hinduism? It is a very, very complex religion. But how do I know that I am a Hindu? Who am I? There are certain principles by which we know that we are Hindus. Every Hindu, whoever believes in the Vedas, he is a Hindu. If he says, I believe in God, but I don't believe in the Vedas, he is a Nastika, a peculiar concept. Why? Because it is through the Vedas that you come to know there is a God and your a correct conception of God. This is the idea. So it is through the Vedas we know that God can reveal himself in any form, in any name, with any name, with any quality, anywhere in this world, in the past, in the present, and in the future. It is only a Hindu. In Hinduism, one says, we are all divine. Each soul is divine. Everything is divine. Soul means not only living being, every non-living being. The whole creation is divine. It is only a Hindu who believes everybody will go to God. Nobody is going to be damned. It is only a Hindu who says, I believe God incarnating in every age. It is only a Hindu who says, respect every religion, respect every scripture, respect every prophet, every sage. It is only a Hindu who says, the supreme values of life are four. Righteous living, then enjoy this world through proper way of earning the instruments or money, and enjoy this world in a regulated way, but ultimately liberation or moksha is the highest goal of life. It is Hindu only who believes that God can incarnate any number of times. These are some of the most important things. I put it systematically. I will get it next time and I do it. Shanti, shanti, shanti.